Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight I want to talk about the Education Act 1944, introduced by Rab Butler, who could be seen as perhaps the most radical and reformist conservative minister of the 20th century. However, what we'll see as we go through looking at the Act is the limitations that it actually placed on the post-war educational system, and how it reinforced and replicated the class system using different types of education in order to reinforce different social roles. Now, tonight I'm working from Seton and Curran's Power Without Responsibility, which is a kind of critical history of Britain's press, but it's also a British social history as well. In it, they write, "The needs of war radically altered education and broadcasting. The Education Act 1944, which introduced compulsory secondary education for all, has been seen by many as the finest achievement of a great reforming minister, R.A. Butler, who based it on what he described to his biographer Ralph Harris as a sensationally ingenious report. More recent assessments have been less enthusiastic. According to Brian Simon, through the late 1940s and 1950s, when so much might have been accomplished, the development of secondary education for all was restricted and distorted by the dead hand of a doctrine brought to a point during the depressed 1930s, the doctrine that in effect secondary education is not for all." So what did the 1944 Education Act actually say? Well, it said that schools needed to be reorganised, and I quote, "firstly to provide opportunities for a special cast of mind to manifest itself, indeed to develop specialised interests and aptitudes." The Act was the result of the Board of Education, which would now be the Department for Education. It wasn't really the result of kind of a grassroots pressure for educational change. This was a top-down ministerial approach. And as we shall see, that top-down ministerial approach created certain gradations of education for certain social classes. In 1938... the Spens report had said that it is becoming more and more evident that a simple liberal education for all is impractical. And the Spens report in 1938 said that there was a distinction between children who work with hands, work with tongue, or work with pen. And it suggested that one child differs from another far more than is generally supposed. Now, Speaking as a teacher, the current mode of pedagogical thinking flies in the face of this, despite the kind of fad for neo-traditionalism in education that has swept the UK since, interestingly, the year 2010. There is little evidence that there are children who are operate on sort of kind of higher levels and are more suited to the pen than the hand. In fact, most of these distinctions seem to be artificially created, and that there are abundant aptitudes of all sorts of different natures inherent within children. But I don't want to kind of digress too much, because that's a different conversation. The Norwood Report and the 1944 Education Act said that the differences between children could be classed into different groups of children, so that there were three different groupings, really. The child, and I quote, who is interested in learning for its own sake, who is interested in the causes and who can grasp an argument. He, and it was referring to he's particularly, is sensitive, he's interested in the relatedness of related things. He will have some capacity to enjoy from an aesthetic point of view. This was the child that was going to go to the grammar school. The distinct feature of which lies in the intellectual ideal which it upholds. The category of school was to retain the values which had been intended for all schools before the war, and was to produce a new professional and managerial elite. So the point of the grammar schools after the war was to create this kind of managerial class that would run things in a new and uncertain world, the world of the post-war era, the Cold War, the Atomic Age, changes in the empire. It was going to need an educated class of what you would refer to in the civil service as generalists, people that that enjoy knowledge for its own sake. And that would mean somebody who could be applied to the Board of Trade or the Foreign Office, and would be equally adaptable in both. There is a second class of child described, who, and I quote, often has the uncanny insight into the intricacies of mechanisms, whereas the subtleties of language and construction are too delicate for him. To justify itself to his mind, knowledge must be capable of immediate application. So these were going to be the technicians of the future. These were going to be the scientists, the engineers. These were going to be the computer programmers and the chemists. And it's interesting that this sort of caste was seen as something rather inferior to the first child, who is interested in the relatedness of related things and interested in learning for its own sake. One of the problems that it could be argued has dogged post-war Britain is kind of here in this distinction, in that the classicist, the generalist, and the managerial intellectual, as kind of personified by the sort of the civil service mandarin, or the political or the media class, has really always outweighed in terms of significance and importance the engineer, the chemist, the biologist, or the computer scientist, whereas it tends to be that latter group that are far more crucial to the development of the economy and economic productivity and economic growth. The third class of child would go to the secondary modern school. The third class of child was described as the child who may have much ability, but it will be in the realm of facts. He is interested in things as they are. He must have immediate return for his effort. The secondary modern schools were to be separate from the other, from the grammar schools, supposedly equal, and they were meant to have parity of prestige. There is a kind of an immensely kind of obfuscated language here. So I'll just go through that one again. That they may have much ability, but it will be in the realm of facts. He is interested in things as they are. So he is, and again, apologies for the gendered language here, but this is how things were thought of in 1944. This child is a more simple thinker. He doesn't want to live in the realms of intellect. He doesn't want to live in the realms of scientific inquiry. He wants to know what's what. And particularly, the implication here is wants to be told what's what. And this was going to be the bottom tier of the middle class and perhaps the top tier of the working class. The purpose of the modern school was distinct. The children would need education in order to not only deal with the world of work, but to understand the world of leisure as well. So, and I quote, "This homely aspect of education is often the basis of future happiness and is as vitally necessary as it can be interesting." So girls would be told to bake and sew, and boys would have woodwork classes. Again, these things would be entirely gendered, and being able to teach working class children, and it was particularly thought of as being a thing for working class children, how to deal with the workings of life itself, how to deal with the tasks of the home and of child rearing and all that kind of thing, was important. The Norwood Report, on which the Butler Act is based, Seton and Watson speak of it like this: "It was implicit in the Norwood Report and the Act that there were children who could think, children who could do, and then the rest." And there would be scope in this system for able children from lower class backgrounds to go to grammar school and go to technical school. However, the impediments placed in the way of able children from poorer backgrounds, the impediments that poverty itself creates, profoundly disadvantaged able children from reaching their potential, and it was far more likely that they would wind up in secondary modern schools, and the system would favour.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Middle class children and upper class children who would be able to find their place in the school that was going to be the stepping stone to the future that their parents had probably enjoyed. Already by the 1940s, the ideas that underpin the Act and underpin the Norwood Report were seen as being out of date. For example, the educational psychologist Cyril Burt said that he had, throughout the 1930s, already conducted research which showed that there weren't these kind of mythical separate mental types of the cerebral intellectual child, the little boy with a chemistry set, and then the kind of the lumpen proletariat down at the bottom. That these were social constructs, not inherent biological or genetic types. In fact, the evidence that Cyril Burt showed was that any individual who had above average intelligence in one aspect would more than likely have above average intelligence in all aspects of learning. Therefore, it made a nonsense out of the idea of grammar schools and technical colleges and indeed secondary moderns, that potentially all children could cope and flourish and thrive in a grammar school environment if given the right level of support and help and development. Cyril Burt wrote, "It's difficult to see how even administrative necessity can lead us to discern the indistinguishable and to find three types of mind when they do not exist." The irony, of course, as far as Burt was concerned, was that the selection process for dividing up children into these three tranches was going to use some of the methodologies that he himself had devised to test intelligence. One way to think about the Education Act 1944 and the channeling of children into three broad categories was that it was kind of a product of the war. This is exactly how men had been scientifically, and not just men in fact, women who'd served as well, had been scientifically, or supposedly scientifically, channeled into roles that fitted their aptitudes. And men had been in the army prioritised towards officer posts or towards technical or specialist roles based on their aptitudes and intelligence, and in the case of officers, university degrees. In the immediate post-war era, many of the principles used to manage labour and resources and time that had been put to great effect to win the war were translated into peacetime, and there were processes that were already pre-existing in order to bring about dramatic changes in education, in healthcare, in housing, and in other key areas of reconstruction. Two significant army psychologists during the war wrote, "The value of vocational or educational classification lies not merely in the closer coordination of human capacity with job, but also with their effects on morale. Therefore, this meant that workers were generally happier if they weren't interfered with and didn't have to associate themselves with things far beyond their capabilities. Or they were happier if they weren't put into roles which made them feel uncomfortable, i.e. Managerial or officer roles. And so this meant that streaming workers into working class roles and working class children into working class educational situations after the war would be ultimately the kind of paternalist and benign thing to do. Don't essentially put a working class boy into grammar school into circumstances that he can't deal with. That's not to say that working class boys didn't go to grammar school. There are significant numbers that did, but they were outnumbered by their middle-class classmates considerably. Technical education had also been a product of the war. During the war, there was a greater increase in chemistry and physics and the developing interest from the 1950s onwards in things such as genetics and computer science. Cabinet Secretary Lord Maurice Hankey wrote in 1941 that technical colleges, although ill-housed, ill-equipped and understaffed, had responded without hesitation to the needs of the services and industry and had magnificently reorganised themselves to train men and women for the war effort. And it was thought that the post-war world would be one where scientific advance would be what Britain was based on, Britain's competitive advantage in the world and its strategic and military advantage, its ability to hold on to its empire and its ability to sit at the top table with the Soviet Union and the USA, which is increasingly a fantasy, was going to be based around understanding of technology, atomic weapons, for example. So there was a perceived need for an army of technically skilled workers who were able to rise to the challenge of a new atomic age. The only problem was that they rarely were built. The technical schools didn't emerge in the numbers that were hoped for. They barely emerged in any numbers at all. There was little money after the Second World War, and during the war, the government had been quite able to direct the allocation of the workforce and to tell men and women where they were going and what they were doing. In the post-war world, it was far more difficult to tell people that they were and their children were going to be the scientists of Britain in the future, and that they were designated really to lead Britain's technological revolution. During the Second World War, normal kind of democratic and civil liberties are to somewhat curtailed. In the aftermath, these are immediately resumed. However, it was generally hoped that industry would look for educated and technically educated school leavers. And this demand for educated school leavers would put pressure on government to provide them, and it would also mean that industry would be the next phase of these young people's technical education, and industry and the state would work hand in hand to create generations of scientifically skilled workers. And of course, this was but fantasy. This doesn't occur. Employers wanted and continued to favour young men and women with general academic skills, and it was one of the failings of British industry in the post-war era, with some notable exceptions, of course, but overall one of the failings of British industry to continue to innovate in the ways that, for example, Germany and Japan were forced to in the 1950s and 1960s. Rab Butler wrote in 1942 that education cannot by itself create the social structure of a country. I have to take the world as I find it, and the world I find is one in which there is a very diversified range of types. Educational progress must be along the grain of human nature. That said, the Education Act 1944 itself did try to mould human nature, unsuccessfully, largely. It was an act of largely of social engineering. It wasn't really simply an acceptance of how young people are or how children are or how learning is, or an acceptance of the status quo. And it was a significant change in how the state viewed children and viewed learning, knowledge and education. It was really a way of reformulating social class after the upheavals of the Second World War, really, or actually after the upheavals of the first half of the 20th century. And it represented a new recognition of class and a fragmentation of culture. Seton and Cohen write, "The old liberal culture survived, but was confined to the curricula of the professionals in their grammar schools, while in the modern schools, children for whom exams were inappropriate were taught how to entertain themselves." It's for these reasons that British society has really fought an almost never-ending culture war over the issue of education since the Second World War, with the rise and the fall of grammar schools in the post-war era, and endless modern moral panics about the secondary school system, all the way to the era of academies and free schools that we live under now. Those are topics from another time, I guess. Okay, so I hope you've enjoyed this one and you found it useful. And if you're studying post-war Britain, I'm sure it will be, hopefully anyway. Do swing by the Facebook page. We've got a lot of stuff going on there at the moment. And I'm going to be putting some more content up in the very near future. We've got, if you go back and listen to the previous book review, there's still a copy of Babushka's War ready up for grabs, so make sure you claim your copy of that, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks, bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.